Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Today, it's the real reasons our produce doesn't have much taste. Our guest is LA Times journalist Russ Parsons. Now, he says that if you understand how farming works in America, you see the flavor issue differently. His book is How to Pick a Peach, The Search for Flavor from Farm to Table. Well, the man who lives to grill, Gourmet Magazine's John Willoughby, says banish the marinade. He's got something faster and better. Anya von Bremsen critiques her way through the world's restaurants for Travel and Leisure magazine. Now, she's got a tally of the best new places to eat on the planet in some unexpected locations. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's get things going the way we do every week with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine.
If you remember over the years, but Michael has a complete hostility towards Belgian waffles. He likes like the thin tread waffles, not the big ones. We finally found a place in Akron, Ohio, called Beside the Point that Michael has now surrendered to the art of the Belgian waffle.
So what are these waffles like that Michael has finally put his stamp of approval on them?
Well, they're relatively thick compared to the thin tread waffle that I normally like, but they're really elegant. They're not the doughy kind of Belgian waffle you usually get. They're actually made in irons imported from Belgium, and you can get plain ones or you can get, you know, chocolate chips or fruits in them, but they're made to order, and you can stand there opposite Chef Philip, who makes these, and as he makes them, you can decide what you want in or on them, and he's willing to do whatever you want with your waffle, and they're really elegant. I mean, that's what I love about them. That's what I love about the thin waffles, and that's what I do not like about the typical Belgian waffle you get anywhere else.
It's really kind of an interesting place. Beside the Point is primarily a grocery store.
Yeah. But not an ordinary grocery store.
No, not especially not in Akron.
It's almost like a, sort of a shopping boutique. The lights are low. The ceilings are relatively low compared to a supermarket. Huh. It's a huge place. It's got a whole chocolatier, a florist, a butcher shop, kitchenware department. But going through these aisles is nothing like going through a garish supermarket.
And the great thing with these waffles, aside from the fact that they're made in these special hot irons right in front of you, is what's put on them is so high quality. I mean, it's not the usual, you know, whipped cream out
right.
of a can.
Yeah, right, exactly.
You can just get plain sweet butter with syrup, or my favorite, which is homemade cinnamon apples and caramel syrup, uh-huh. which is just terrific.
Yeah.
And I always say hold the whipped cream. I just like them to be a little bit less desserty.
I have always pegged you as a woman of great restraint, Jane.
Right.
So you sit down there in this sounds, I have to tell you, it sounds like a very sexy place.
It's very cool. I mean, the Beside the Point Cafe is like one corner of the market, and they serve breakfast, lunch, and possibly even dinner. I don't remember, but it's a kind of cozy little place where they have some boutique-y kind of food as well. I mean, Jane, I think, loved it not only for the waffles, but because they make wonderful espresso coffee. Jane had about, a six-shot espresso to start the day along with her waffle.
We were brought there by the food editor of the Akron paper.
Jane Snow.
Jane Snow, who's a, you know, talk about a valuable resource. And she said, would you like to go to the gourmet market? And Michael and I both went, you know, no. And she said, really, you will be missing something if you don't. And she was right. And she also said that her favorite thing there is a classic killer brownie, which is this giant amalgam of chopped walnuts and dark chocolate chips. And it is truly over the top.
In fact, when we went there, they were celebrating the 25th anniversary of the killer brownie.
Oh, well, you had to, right? I mean, how could you not?
How could we resist after our waffles? Who doesn't need dessert after a waffle?
You know, I have to say, it's really lovely to hear, Michael, that after all of these years, you can still be surprised.
I'm so flexible and adaptable.
I know. It's amazing. Hey, guys, thank you.
Bye,
Lynn.
Well, shifts and safety belts. Bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving. In the car, it makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of Road Food Sandwiches. Now, they check in here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. 20-some years ago, I took an all-day bread class at a crucial moment in my work, just when I was doubting if anyone would give two hoots about meticulous historical research into what shaped the food of one small part of Italy. I met our teacher, Karen Hess. Well, she's been called the scholar's scholar, outspoken, demanding, and brilliant. Now, the subject of that class was on the origins of American bread from today's puffy white all the way back to Karen's discovery that the wheat that we grew in the 1700s was the same strain used today in France by artisan bakers. Karen Hess restored my faith, as she did many others. Well, we lost Karen recently. She was 89 years old. She never had a television show or a bestseller, but she leaves a legacy of demanding scholarship that's rarely equaled by others in the field. She was remarkable, opinionated, and challenging. And we're not going to see her like again. I've put a list of Karen's work up on the website. You can find it at splendidtable.org. You probably know John Willoughby from the masthead of Gourmet magazine. He's second from the top, executive editor. But if you're a cookbook fan, you know about his books on grilling and meats, written with his pal, Chef Chris Slazinger. These two keep winning awards. Their latest is Let the Flames Begin. John, welcome back.
Thank you, Lynn. It's good to be back.
You know, I think of this as your season, grilling season.
This is my season, yeah, I have to admit it.
Exactly. And I remember you saying something about marinades really aren't worth the effort, and I'd love for you to expand on that.
You know, I think that's true. I am not a big fan of marinades, and one of the reasons is you have to think in advance. You have to remember that you have to put the stuff in the marinade, which I'm not very good at. And second, I just don't think that they really give you a whole lot of additional flavor. So I am a very big fan of an alternative, which is spice pastes. And these are just collections of things like garlic, lemongrass, you know, fresh things, scallions, whatever whatever makes sense for the particular part of the world you're using flavors from, along with a lot of spices and then just a few tablespoons of oil. So you make kind of a gloppy little paste and you rub that right on the surface of the food. Now, to me, this has it all over marinades for a lot of reasons. First, you're not diluting the spices. When you put spices in marinade, it's spices in a lot of liquid. This is spices with just enough liquid to make them stick, which is the second point. They stick right to the food. So, you know, you're not leaving behind the flavor in the marinade. You're putting all the flavor right there on the surface of the food. Then when you put that on the grill, it turns that paste into a really nice, dark, super flavorful, spicy crust. And to me, the contrast between that crunchy crust and the tender interior is one of the things that grilling is all about. And one more thing.
Yeah, and?
It also, when you use a marinade, it does get into the food a little bit. I don't really think it tenderizes it as much as people think, but it does penetrate into the food a little bit. So you have a kind of a mixed flavor there of the marinade plus the food. And with these spice pastes, you've got the spicy outside and the inside that's exactly the flavor of the beef or the chicken or whatever it is, unadulterated. So again, in addition to the texture contrast, you get those flavor contrasts, which I think are just great.
So some examples.
Well, you know, the thing to do is look around the world, and there's spice paste everywhere. There's spice paste and there's spice mixes. So one of my favorites is an adobo paste from Mexico. So it's, you know, it's a little olive oil, and you have paprika, oregano, garlic, cumin, some chili peppers, a little bit of lime zest, salt and pepper, and this is awesome on pork. It is really great with pork. It's also good. You can use it on chicken, too, but I think it's best on pork. Mm-hmm. So that's one of mm-hmm. my favorites. Mm-hmm. And then you can do a Southeast Asian-style one, which, you know, it's the flavors of Southeast Asia, very easy. Coriander, lemongrass, some ginger and garlic. A shallot is good. Some nice jalapeno chilies mm-hmm. or Thai bird chilies. A little bit of sesame oil just to dilute it, and that's it. And this actually works really well with beef. I love it with beef. Also with lamb. You know, you just mix that up, put it on, put the food over the grill, and you're there.
And you're done.
And you're done. And these things, most of them last for about a week in the refrigerator. So they can be one of those super secret weapons that you just keep in your refrigerator. And whenever you want to make dinner, all you do is rub some of it on, you know, meat, chicken, fish, put it on the grill, and you've got your dinner.
Do you think they always have to be wet? I mean, could you just do dry spices with this?
I do like dry rubs as well, but I think the pastes have become my favorite. I used to really be a big fan of dry rubs, which I still am, but the pastes have overtaken them recently for two reasons. They stick better to the food, mm-hmm. and sometimes dry rubs, if you're cooking over a high-heat fire, yeah. they'll burn a little bit, and the oil in these pastes kind of makes this the cooking process happen a little more slowly, so the spices tend to toast instead of burn.
Yeah, and probably there's a moistening quality to these as well.
If you put them on the outside, it does keep the it does protect the meat inside from the high heat of the fire a little bit. Mm-hmm. So they're going to be a little more tender and a little more moist.
There's a point you bring out here that I think is interesting too, where you say marinades, the flavors just aren't as intense, and I think that applies to brines as well. I'll see brine recipes where you're brining I don't know how much meat. And there's two cloves of garlic and one sprig of thyme, and you're never going to taste that.
No, it reminds me of people who like to burn grapevines in their fire, in an open fire.
Yeah.
I mean, you
yeah.
can smell it, but it's not going to affect the food. And you're right. You put a couple of sprigs of rosemary and a couple of cloves of garlic in a big marinade in which you're doing a whole roast. You're never going to taste that. So it's just wasted time.
Yeah.
You know, when
yeah.
I brine now, I just use salt, sugar, and water. I don't put any flavorings in because I just don't think they have much of an effect. I save the flavorings for the paste.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, John, thank you.
Thank you, Wynn.
John Willoughby is executive editor of Gourmet Magazine and co-author of Let the Flames Begin. Now, you can find John's recipe for adobo pork ribs on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're on the site, be sure to register for Weeknight Kitchen. It's an e-newsletter devoted to simplifying your culinary life midweek. Each week, we send you a worknight supper recipe and shopping and technique tips. And you're also going to find free podcasts of our show. So you can take us anywhere. And it's all free. So it's on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, how our food is grown or searching for flavor down on the farm and the best new restaurants in the world. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget, one-stop shopping for groceries, cookware, and entertaining. You can find them online at target.com/SuperTarget. When you read L.A. Times food journalist Russ Parsons, you get a smart man who thinks right on to the page. Russ digs into all the sides of an issue and lays them out for you. But his love of food and his curiosity has had him tracking American agriculture for over 20 years. Now, his latest book is How to Pick a Peach, The Search for Flavor from Farm to Table. Hey, Russ, it's good to have you back.
Oh, it's wonderful to be here, Lynn. Thank you.
So, what did you want to do with this book?
Well, I wanted to kind of explain to people, to home cooks, where their food is coming from and why the fruits and vegetables are the way they are. I think there's a great deal of interest now in all of these kinds of buzzwords, you know, organic and sustainable, mm-hmm. and everybody goes to farmers markets. And I wanted to help people kind of make some sense of it.
One of the things you do in the book is that you present a very real-world take. You don't seem to be passing judgment, talking about large-scale farming in this country. And you point out that
America has the lowest price food per capita of almost any other country in the Western world.
Exactly. And we pay less than half for our food than what Americans paid around World War II.
Wow.
So in the last 60 years, there has been this great revolution. And now we're living with the after effects of that revolution, the unintended consequences.
There's a section of the book where you really get into this. You talk about how that peach gets from the farm to the market. And you're talking, I think, about the peach harvest in the San Joaquin Valley. And you talk about the peach harvest for the big farmer and the peach harvest for the small farmer. Could you walk us through that so we could understand the differences?
Sure. If you want to understand why big farming works the way it does, there are really two things that you have to understand. The first is a very simple statistic, and that is that according to the last census of agriculture, three-fourths of farm family income now comes from off-farm sources. That's second jobs, third jobs, you know, the other partner working full-time. Farmers are strapped. They don't have the luxury of willy-nilly doing exactly what they want to do.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that you have to understand is how the produce distribution system works. For a farmer, there's really no financial incentive to grow great fruit. There is financial incentive to grow more fruit, but not to grow better fruit. And so what farmers do is they start hedging their bets. You know, they start picking things earlier. They start growing varieties that may not have the best flavor, but that are more reliable and more disease resistant, maybe they produce more heavily. They pump up the fruit with a lot of water and maybe with other fertilizers and things like that, trying to get the biggest, best-looking fruit, but it doesn't necessarily have much flavor. If you want good flavor, there are a lot of things that you have to do that will cut down on the size of your harvest. The first thing is, of course, that you're probably going to have to grow varieties that aren't overly productive, but that have great flavor. That's that's a real fundamental decision. You're going to have to, early in the season, they have what they call the green harvest, which is when they go through and they thin the trees, where they lose, you know, they may lose half of the fruit. They just drop it on the ground. It's not mature fruit yet. It's just the little bitty baby peaches.
Yeah.
They cut them off and put them on the ground so that the peaches that are left get all of the nutrients that are coming through the tree so that there's the same amount of nutrients going to fewer peaches.
So essentially you're taking half of what you're growing and you're discarding it.
Exactly. And that's only the first time you do that. As the peaches mature, there are all these things that can happen to it. There's bugs that can get into it. There are funguses. There are hailstorms. There are windstorms. There's rainstorms. All of these things, you know, it's like rolling a dice. I mean, for you or I, if we miss a day of work, it's like, okay, well, tomorrow I'll make up for it.
Yeah.
If you're a peach farmer and you wait one extra day and there's a hailstorm, you've lost the entire year's work. I guess it's kind of like not having your computer backed up, you know?
Yeah.
Everything's gone. That's it. And you start on the next season, but that season's wiped out. And then at the end of the harvest, there's even more fruit left on the ground because of all of these risks that they've taken, there are more and more cosmetic blemishes on the fruit. And so the fruit may split. There may be marks on the fruit. There may be some of it may not be as appealing as others. All of that stuff goes on the ground too. I remember following one of these great farmers, Art Lang, when he was picking his fruit.
Mm-hmm.
And when they were harvesting for market, they threw as much of the fruit on the ground as they put into the sleeves to go to market. So that's losing another 50% of the fruit.
I'm looking at the dollars and cents here. What kind of money does a large-scale farmer make on that peach? And what kind of money does an Art Lang, the smaller farmer who's aiming at the specialty market, make on the fruit?
Well, a large-scale farmer, the average for a peach farmer today is that they get about 20 cents of every dollar that's spent on retail. And that's for all fruits and vegetables these days.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's a $2 peach, he gets 40 cents.
Okay.
Now, for somebody like an Art Lang, for a farmer's market farmer, they may get $3 a pound for their peaches or even $4 a pound. Sometimes, like for a guy like Art, you know, we keep using him as the exemplar. And if you've ever had the opportunity to taste one of his peaches, you'll understand why that is. I mean, this is fruit that really makes the hair stand up on the back of your neck. when his first, like, he grows this great white peach called a Snow Queen. When the first Snow Queens come in, he can get $5 a pound for those things, and there will be people standing in line to buy them.
Mm-hmm.
But because the harvest is so much smaller, his net income may not be any more than the guy who's growing lots of peaches. The other part of it is that selling at farmers markets is not this kind of magic panacea, because farmers markets take a heck of a lot of work. I mean, in the first place, you have to go sell the stuff. You know, for a regular farmer, for a mainstream farmer, what he does is a picking crew comes in, picks all of the stuff, and that's the last he sees it.
Right.
You know, then it goes to a packing house, and the packing house takes care of everything else. You know, he grows the fruit, that's it. For someone who's involved in these kinds of other niche ways of selling fruit, whether it's a farmer's market or it's community-supported agriculture or these alternate ways of selling, they have to become marketers at the same time. And not only do they have to become marketers, they have to become truck drivers. I mean, Art Lang's in Fresno. Most of his customers are either in San Francisco or in Los Angeles. So that means a 4 or 5 hour drive each way to be able to stand outside for 4 hours in the morning selling his peaches.
There's nothing simple here. Russ, thank you.
Thanks so much, Lynn.
Russ Parsons' latest book is How to Pick a Peach, The Search for Flavor from Farm to Table. Well, Russ left us with a recipe for sugar snap peas and shrimp with chive mayonnaise. You can get it on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, sign up for our brand new e-newsletter, The Griller's Chronicle. It's going to run from June to September, and every week you're going to get a new grilling recipe, along with our usual trenchant observations and profound insights. And best of all, it's free. So sign up for Griller's Chronicle at splendidtable.org. Food journalist Anya von Bremsen's beat is The World. She writes about the evolving restaurant scenes around the globe for Travel and Leisure magazine, Food and Wine, and the LA Times. She's author of The Greatest Dishes Around the World in 80 Recipes. Hey, Anya, welcome back.
Great to be here, Lynn.
You know, you've literally been eating around the world over the past year, and you're looking at what's new. So what are the shifts? What is happening around the world?
Well, in traveling for the story for Travel and Leisure on the best new restaurants, I've crisscrossed the world to 8 cities. Very interesting, you know, definitely trends emerge. One is French chefs traveling up a storm. Everywhere you go, here's Joël Robuchon. Here's another 3-star luminaries. They used to not get out of Paris much. Mm-hmm. And now with Alain Ducasse launching a global brand, everyone wants to get into the fray. So welcome to the Gallicization of the world. Another thing you see all over the place is Wagyu beef, Japanese beef. Mm-hmm. You might have heard about Kobe beef, you know, the most prized beef from Japan. Mm-hmm. And Kobe is just one of the types of Wagyu beef. It's this very fatty, hand-pampered, hand-massaged cow that produces, you know, the most marbled, the most sought-after beef in the world, and it's like the new caviar. You know, obviously globalization, we're seeing the same design trends, the same ingredients, the same names of dishes. On the other hand, you know, there's something completely opposing, which is, you know, eating fresh, small, local. We're seeing, because of real estate issues, because of economic realities, you either launch a global place with a global backing, or you launch a small place, you know, 6 tables, 12 tables with a very chefy, individual, quirky sensibilities, local suppliers, local producers. So these two are sort of opposing things is what we're seeing. But in each city, it's a little bit different.
Where do these trends really stand out? I mean, are there certain cities where you see this kind of trend in the wildest extremes?
Obviously, Tokyo, I have to say, the most exciting food city continues to be Tokyo. You can find a little donut shop from New York that's just, you know, an esoteric thing popping up in a Tokyo subway station. They went to New York, they copied it, and it's a perfect replica. You can go to this extravagant tofu place that I love, Tofu Ya Ukai, which is, you know, completely a replica of 19th century gardens and palace that sits under the shadow of a replica of the Eiffel Tower in Paris. How is that for global irony? Amazing. And the food, you know, everything that they bring back from Italy, from Spain, from New York, they do it better. You know, a 3-Michelin-star Spanish chef has a copy of their restaurant in Tokyo. And she says, you know what, it's better than my original. Unbelievable.
But there are two places in your list that I like because they're destinations we don't think about. Montreal and Melbourne. Can you talk about Montreal?
Montreal is going through a really good stage right now. Well, first of all, for us Americans, it's so close. We could just hop over. It's so much cheaper with the Canadian dollar being what it is. Mm-hmm. And it's just a fun place. You know, it's gentrifying. The energy is great. And Montreal is exactly the place where you're not finding this huge global imports. You're finding this quirky chef-driven restaurant. One place that I love and then everyone in Montreal loves is called Joe Beef. It's kind of part Parisian bistro, part New England oyster bar. They have this great oysters, you know, with world champion Shocker with tattoos, arms. And then they have this cuisine grand-mère, you know, grandmotherly French-Canadian cooking, you know, like some insanely rich chicken braised forever in cream or, you know, a wonderful steak with bone marrow. Just exactly the kind of food that we want to eat right now. And it feels like you've crashed a party at someone's living room. It's tiny. You get to know all your neighbors, and it's precisely the sort of personal little restaurant. The other place I really liked was L'Atelier, and they focus on Canadian ingredients. You know, Quebecois cheeses, local game. They do a lot of, you know, venison, rabbit. Very interesting. Mm. Again, a quirky place. So if you go to Montreal, this is where you're going to find very individual kind of restaurant.
That Australia. Now, when you think Australia, most of us hear about Sydney, but you've written about Melbourne.
You know, there's been a rivalry between those two cities forever. And Melbourne is coming up on top. One, you know, sort of chefy, individual little place that everyone loves, that has gotten every award, is called 312. And it's a combination of Pacific Rim cuisine with, you know, some global French accent. Andrew McConnell is a chef, very talented. But the other place that everyone has talked about is Rockpool Bar and Grill. And Rockpool is a Sydney restaurant that's run by superstar chef Neil Perry, the most famous chef in Australia. Mm-hmm. And finally, Perry has come to Melbourne and opened a steakhouse. And finally, Melbournians are saying, well, now we've got Neil Perry, we've got, you know, the sort of small, interesting individual restaurants. You know, we are, you know, leading the way, and the Australian press seems to agree. So it's a big moment for Melbourne. Wonderful place to visit.
Anya, thank you.
Great to be here.
Anya von Bremsen is contributing editor to Travel and Leisure magazine. Her article, The Best New Restaurants in the World, appeared in the April 2007 issue. Noreen hunts down spices. Now, I am not talking foraging through the fancy food shows. This woman treks through marketplaces in Africa and Aborigine communities in Australia. This woman sources at the source. Now, Nirmala's spice business is Nirmala's Kitchen. Her first book is In Nirmala's Kitchen, Everyday World Cuisine. Nirmala, welcome.
Hi, Lynn. How are you?
I am good. Now, you know, I know you're drawn to the unusual in spices, but there is a spice that I'm thinking about. It is practically ubiquitous, and we never think about it. And it's turmeric.
Yes.
Where does it come from? Is it a seed?
Well, it is it's part of the ginger family, and it looks just like ginger, but very much sort of like half the size of what a ginger root would look like. Mm-hmm. And it's indigenous to Southeast Asia, particularly South India. And it's very, very ancient. And to sort of like break it down so people know what it is, it's that yellow stuff that you see when you go into an Indian restaurant and you have like a curry dish. That's what it is. It's what gives the curry that yellow color, even in Thai dishes too. And it has a very the characteristic is sort of like very musky and pungent, slightly bitter, very earthy aroma. You even find it not only in savory dishes, but also in sweets. Like if you go into Indian shops, you'll find the yellow color sweets. It's also, it used to pass on as saffron.
Yeah,
you know,
wasn't
because
it a
it's
substitute?
The same color. Yeah,
yeah,
it's a substitute of saffron, and if you and it's also used as for religious purposes in Buddhism and Hinduism. They dye their robes, like you see the monks have their saffron color robes, but you know it's really dyed with turmeric back then, and a lot of Hindus, the women when they wear sari, sometimes it's dyed with turmeric. So it has a lot of different use.
Is there a turmeric that stands out?
Yeah, the one that I really found when I was in my travels is the Alpepri turmeric. It's more sort of like deep orange, sort of like brownish, but it has a very citrusy flavor that I really like.
How do you use it? I mean, do you ever use it as a flavoring on its own?
Hardly. Only the fresh ones. And you could find the fresh ones in Indian supermarkets. Sometimes the sign will say turmeric or it will say haldi, H-A-L-D-I or H-A-L-D-E.
Uh-huh.
And it will just sit right next to the ginger in the grocery store. But I basically use the fresh ones if I wanted to make like custards and so forth. Uh-huh. I could go ahead and grate it and infuse it and the cream comes like this beautiful bright yellow with a hint of citrus notes to it. And the dry one, I just use it in any sort of curry dishes I want to make. If it's Indian, Malaysian, Singapore, Thai, Thai soups and so forth. And I sometimes use it to make tea. So, and I fuse it with ginger, fresh ginger.
Mm. Nirmala, thank you.
Thank you.
Nirmala Naren's book is In Nirmala's Kitchen, Everyday World Cuisine. Now, you can work some turmeric into your life with Nirmala's recipe for Goan Vindaloo fish curry. You can find it on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what does turmeric symbolize? Well, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, a grocery store and Target all in one, where guests can have their cake and a plate to eat it on, too. Online at target.com/supertarget. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. But first, I have got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what does turmeric symbolize? Turmeric symbolizes auspiciousness. At least it does in the Tamilian festival in southern India. Now, the festival is called Pongal. It is in mid-January, and it celebrates the sun beginning to move northward. It's a time for sweeping away the darkness and bringing sunlight into the world. Well, generosity is at the heart of the festival. Servants are treated as brothers, the poor are fed, and turmeric roots are placed on altars as a form of worship. Now, one dish that they make is rice cooked in milk, decorated with turmeric leaves and roots. I mean, you can imagine that pungent yellow of the turmeric being seen as the sun on the white rice. Well, turmeric is also painted on doorways to ward off insects, and turmeric roots are exchanged between people as a token of goodwill. It's pretty impressive for a spice that we just look at in the supermarket as part of curry powder.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's
pick up that phone, give us a call, and we will talk. The number is 800-537-5252. Let's see, we have got Steve calling from Minneapolis. Hey, Steve, what do you want to talk about?
Oh, Lynn, thank you so much for taking the call.
You are welcome.
So I've got this spice mix that I need more of, and I can't figure out how to get more of. This is what happened is my wife, about a year ago, was doing some consulting work with some government folks in Iraq.
Uh-huh.
And she bought this a bag of this spice mix. And, I mean, it's essentially a Ra's al Hanout that she bought from some guy on a rooftop of a hotel or something.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It's not like I can exactly, you know, go back to Baghdad and pick up some more.
Yeah, and mail order is not going to happen. Yeah,
exactly, not at the moment. And so I have tried to use it so sparingly, and it's so good. And I'm running low, and I can smell some of the ingredients, and I know some of the basics of it. And I know that it is often in Iraq used in a chicken and rice dish called biryani.
But
everybody makes their Ra's al Hanout a little bit differently, and so I got to figure out who is the spice guru or something. I can send a sample of this stuff to, and they can reverse engineer it for me or something.
It's a very good question. You know, the spice mixture is most famous as being part of Moroccan cuisine.
Yes.
But it's probably used all over the Arab world. And what I know about it is, have you ever seen a book? It came out in the 70s, but it's still out there. And it is still one of the best things that's been done on the subject. It's called Couscous and Other Good Food from Morocco by Paula Wolfert.
Okay.
Yeah, she's continued to write a great deal about the Mediterranean. But this was her first book. She had lived in Morocco. And Paula is the kind of person who will work for weeks to be able to gain the trust of the woman who is the best cook in the village you've never heard of. And she's authenticity is, you know, the code she lives by. And she has in the book some of the, I mean, and she makes the point, as you're saying, everybody's mixture is different. It can have, do you know that Ra's al Hanout, from what she says, can have from 10 to 100 different ingredients?
I know it.
And but she gives some recipes, and that might be a good place to begin. But this is what I'm wondering. Penzies is one spice house, and then there is the Spice House, which are two of the and Vans Spices as well. And I know these people are on the web, and I am just wondering if a note to them saying, you know, this is a long shot, but I still have a sample of this, and do you think by the farthest stretch of the imagination you could duplicate it? That's one way I'd go. The other thing is that if you think you know what you're smelling from it, you know, I'd say start mixing. But one of the tricks, as you probably know, is most of the time this is ground from whole spices.
Yes.
And one of the things that always surprised me about the Moroccan blends I had come across was that there were two seemingly constant ingredients. I mean, there was things like, you know, allspice and dried ginger, not ground, but dried ginger root that was pounded, and turmeric and you know, all kinds of, you know, spices that you would imagine. But two things that kept showing up that were really interesting was galangale is also known as Laos root, and it's used a lot in Indonesian food.
Huh.
And you can find it fresh in Asian markets, but you can also find sometimes dried chunks of it that you would want to pound or grind in a blender or, you know, a spice blend. The other ingredient would be rosebuds.
Rosebuds?
Dried rosebuds. Now, I know our food cop, you live in Minneapolis, right?
I do. And I actually took some of this into Penzies, and they're, at least by smell and look, they could figure out what I could figure out. I mean, there's definitely coriander. There's definitely cumin. It's very strong,
and that's
with clove.
Yeah, and that would be common. There would probably be cinnamon. There would probably be allspice. There would be a fair amount of black pepper in it.
But it's these other, the galangale and the rosebud and things like that that I just...
Now, if you go to an Asian market and you try to find galangale, you'll find it's going to look a lot like ginger. It's
okay.
A rhizome. And smell it. You're going to see what it smells like. And then see if they have it dried. If they don't have it dried, you can just slice it thinly, put it out on the on the windowsill and dry it, and then work from there. But those two things add this hard to explain.
And what I'm missing.
Maybe so. And the other thing is, look at anise, look at turmeric, look at things like orris root, which has often been used as a preservative in things like pomanders and potpourris. But these are the ingredients you wouldn't expect. Lavender is another ingredient that occasionally turns up. So, I can't tell you because, you know, if we could smell it together, we'd probably both be sitting there saying, now, what is the rest of it? But I know these are the things that I have never forgotten. And I know that the co-ops in Minneapolis and St. Paul do sell dried flower buds there where they sell spices. And I think there's rosebuds there.
Cool.
But
this is going to be fun. So I'm just going to mix away, and if I don't exactly match it, maybe I'll come up with something else really delicious.
Exactly. I mean, mixing lavender and ginger root and dried, you know, rosebuds. I mean, with everything else, what could be bad?
No, it doesn't sound too terrible. Not a bad Saturday afternoon to me.
I think that's a great idea, and you put a little bit behind your ears. You never know what might happen in your life.
Hey, Steve, my wife right back to Baghdad.
Hey, Stephen, enjoy. And I think you're going to have a blast with this.
I think so, too. Thanks so much, Glenn.
You are welcome. Take care. Bye-bye. You can call us, 800-537-5252. It's so interesting what cultures use and the things you never expect. Rosebuds, lavender, I love it. 800-537-5252. We have Roger calling from Huntington, West Virginia. Roger, what do you want to talk about?
A spaghetti sauce or a pasta sauce that I had years ago.
Uh-huh.
It was called Matriciana. I'm not even sure I'm saying it right.
It's Amatriciana, and you're saying it right. You just needed an A.
Can you tell me how to spell it?
I'm sounding it out. A-M-A, Amatri, T-R-I-C-I-A-N-A.
Okay. Well, putting that A in the front might help me find it if I look for it, but, oh, it was so good.
Where did you have it?
In New York, upstate New York, place called Hopewell Junction.
I have to tell you, this is one of the great classic sauces of central Italy. When you go to Rome, every restaurant serves it, and it comes from the mountain area that lies between the region that Rome is part of, which is Lazio, and the mountain border with the neighboring region, which is called Abruzzo. And it is spicy and tomatoey, and it has pancetta in it. Some people make it these days in America with bacon. Is this what you're remembering?
Yes, it is.
And it has
say that meat again.
Pancetta, P-A-N-C-E-T-T-A. Pancetta is the bacon cut of the pig. And instead of curing it with smoke and sugar and you know, sometimes with water, in Italy, it's salted and it has sometimes spices and herbs. And it's cured. And if it's cured right, it's rolled up. It's rolled up, first of all, into like a cylinder. And it can be cured for like 6 months to the point where it's safe to eat raw.
Wow.
And it's streaks of fat and lean. And with the curing, the fat gets really satiny. But in the case of Amatriciana, what they do is they take a generous amount of olive oil in a big sauté pan and a generous amount of that, of, you know, the pancetta. And you fry the pancetta in that until it's crisp. You pull it out and then you put in hot chili and about half the amount of tomatoes you would use to make a normal tomato sauce.
Mm-hmm.
And you fry that with onion. And until the onion is golden and the tomatoes, all of the liquid from them has evaporated and they're actually starting to almost fry in the oil.
Right.
And then you throw in a lot of garlic or to your own taste. You put the pancetta back and you add the same amount again of tomatoes. And you cook it for maybe 8 or 9 minutes and you're done.
Wow.
And it should have that spicy, porky, olive oil, garlic, onion deliciousness. And the traditional – I know you're getting hungry, right?
Yeah, my mouth's watering. It waters every time I think of it. And this has been, I'm going to tell you, 15 years, maybe only 12, but somewhere along that line, years ago. I haven't had it since, but every time it comes to mind – my mouth just waters for it.
Well, you've got really good bacon in your area, don't you?
Well, yes, we do, actually.
Because, you know, I would try the smokiness of the bacon. This is a case. Normally I say, oh, you should never substitute bacon for pancetta. But I have to tell you something. I think with amatriciana, use some good, thick-cut local bacon to do this with olive oil. Mm-hmm. You will just think you have just gone to heaven. And I've got a recipe for it in my book, Italian Country Table. But just what I just told you will do it. And it's normally served with a pasta that looks like thick spaghetti. It's called bucatini. And it's it looks like spaghetti, but it has a little hole in it. But you could just serve it with spaghetti.
Okay.
But I'd say, just remember, the frying of the tomato and the onion is the real key here. Right. And you've got me so hungry now, I'm ready to Oh, the other thing you finish it with is pecorino romano. And so, in other words, the pecorino cheese that you find a lot of it around. And I'd love you to use an Italian one, but you could use a domestic one, too. But you're gonna love it. 15 years you've waited for this, and now you're going to enjoy it.
I'm sure I will.
You're going to have a ball. Hey, Roger, thank you for calling.
Thank you.
You are welcome.
All right.
Bye. Call us, 800-537-5252. We have Wendy up next. She's calling from Portland, Oregon. Wendy, what do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about marinades for tofu.
Okay.
So I finally figured out that you're supposed to boil the tofu first to make it harder so it doesn't disintegrate in the pan. But now I'm trying to figure out what to use for marinades besides soy sauce and rice vinegar.
Oh, there's a ton of things that you can use. Basically, almost anything that would go on fish or poultry, because tofu tends to be very neutral, you can use on tofu. It doesn't have to be Asian, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. For instance, it could be white wine, finely chopped shallots, and tarragon. Very French.
Okay.
And that would work beautifully, and that would give you a very delicate kind of subtle quality. You could do things like, well, I'm going back to the Asian, you could do things like sesame oil with just grated ginger and a little bit of rice wine. You could do things like black pepper and cinnamon with a tad of olive oil.
Wow.
Yeah, and that takes you sort of into the Middle East, you know, and or allspice could go in there. You could do cumin and coriander and sweet or hot paprika.
Wow.
Again, with a little olive oil just as a vehicle for you. So you see, you've got this whole world out there that you can kind of play with. You can put the diced tofu into salsa and just a nice fresh tomato salsa. Let it sit for a little while and just eat it that way.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it's fabulous that way. Utterly fabulous. And if you do the Asian marinades, and don't cook it, just don't cook it. Just do it in, you know, the sesame oil with the fresh ginger and a little rice wine, and maybe a tad of rice vinegar. And then what you want to do is just take some soba noodles and some shredded scallions and just gently mix that together and eat that. It's so delicious. Just delicate, especially as the weather gets warmer. It's one of those things that you just, you want it cold from the refrigerator and you get that great kind of pure taste.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
Yeah, it's really, I've said a lot of unpleasant things about tofu over the years on the show. There was a moment when I made a wisecrack about it, and I really thought, you know, there was a moment where I was a little fearful for my existence. But the reality is that it's always been one of the great neutrals of cooking, in that it becomes so many different things, and on its own, it has this wonderful fragility to it of taste.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do prefer meat, but sometimes I get a hankering for tofu.
You know where I've really started to use it, and I don't want this to get out because people are going to think I'm converted. But the past couple of weeks, I've been doing a miso and mushroom soup. I was inspired by the show's producer, Sally Swift, who did these great sautéed mushrooms with miso in it. And I thought, you know what? What would happen if I added broth to that and some diced tofu? I don't want this to get around, but the reality is I have it in my refrigerator right now, and I kind of like it.
Yeah.
Okay, that's my confession. But essentially, just think in terms of what goes with other more delicate kinds of dishes is going to really be great with this, along with the little shock of salsa and pepper here and there.
Great.
Okay, enjoy.
Okay, well, a wonderful show. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and thanks for calling.
Okay,
Take care. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm not a total convert. I'm just saying my mind is open. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, our answering machine gets so lonely. Call 800-537-5252. And have a great week. And until next time, let me leave you with this thought from Margaret Atwood. She said, "In the spring, at the end of the day, you should smell like dirt." The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Now, everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for our free weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. And get yourself registered for our new seasonal e-newsletter, The Griller's Chronicle. It's going to run through the summer grill season, June to September. And just in case you need even more of us, you can download our weekly podcast. And most remarkable of all of this is free. So sign up for everything, splendidtable.org. Our producers are Sally Swift and Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Jeff Harkness. Have a great week. Please join us next time. And thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.